everyone. Welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. I'll be joined by my colleague Mike Neff momentarily as we break down a wild weekend of racing between the Cup Series and the Xfinity Series at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. We'll go in-depth on the final lap between Kevin Harvick and Denny Hamlin and what could Hamlin have actually done differently. Then, Matt DiBenedetto calls into the show to discuss a fifth-place finish at New Hampshire, his first top-five finish at the Cup level on an oval. And obviously, as you guys have seen over the past month or so, the 95 team is, you know, with the two top five and three top tens in the past five races, has really started to hit its stride since the summer's began. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk New Hampshire with Neff. All right, Neff, we were talking off-air about the race. You didn't like it. I thought New Hampshire was a good race. The traction compound, I thought, added a little bit of racing to New Hampshire standards. Passed the eye test for me. What says you about New Hampshire this weekend?
I mean, as a New Hampshire race goes, it was a New Hampshire race. I thought the traction compound added a little bit because it at least gave the drivers options of how they attacked the corners. You actually had guys going in high and coming down. You had other guys who were kind of diamonding the corners. So it gave you options, but in the end, you couldn't really use those options. I mean, we literally saw one on-track pass for the lead. One. And it was on lap 37. The rest of the race, any of the 13 other lead lap passes were done because of cautions or pit stops. And we saw it at the end, too. I mean, you had Kyle Busch and Ryan Newman on four tires. Busch restarts 10th. Newman restarts, like, 14th or 15th. And they had 28 laps to try to come forward, and Busch gains one spot, and Newman gains, like, six. But neither one of them could crack the top five. And you had guys in front of them on no tires and two tires. So And again, I know we've beat it to death. It's the package, stupid, but it is. I mean, it's the aero dependency is still bad, if not worse. And we've seen it with every package they've done over the last decade. These teams are smart. The guys in the garage are the smartest racing minds in the country, and they're going to figure out how to make these cars fast. The only thing we haven't done is get them off the ground, which I continuously harp on. But for right now, I mean, I'd give it a B, maybe give it a B-plus because of the finish. But in the grand scheme of things, you had a couple, three cars. You know, right at the beginning, there were guys that had to start at the back that did some passing. But once they got up into their similar quality opponents, it was pretty much a parade.
Yeah, that's a good point, for sure. Like you said, Newman, you know, he was one of the guys that had to start in the rear, as was Denny Hamlin. They both get top 10 runs. Alex Bowman, William Byron, and I'm forgetting one other driver that had to start in the rear because of practice crashes. Like you said, Larson and Hamlin got to the top 20 really fast, like within the first eight laps or so. But after that, they're just kind of riding around in a parade, as you mentioned. But overall, I mean, yes, the passing for the lead was minimal at best. You had the one pass, which Kyle also pulled over for Brad. Outside of that, there wasn't much because Kyle used up his tires, which tires did seem to matter a little bit when it came to New Hampshire. But then when you have Kevin Harvick stay out with a good call by Rodney Childers, who we've, you know, criticized on this podcast or been vocal about, maybe he's not the best strategist, leaves him out, gets him the track position, and ultimately hangs on for the last 28 laps, defending off Denny Hamlin for the win.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to show you how important track position is. And, I mean, it's cool for Stuart Haas. They've definitely not had the year that they had last year. And there's been pressure pretty much on everybody in that organization, but especially Harvick, knowing how dominant he was last year. And with Clint Bowyer, who we've talked about it last week about Cole Custer's coming up, and it looks like that's the spot he's going to go into unless Harvick decides to jump into the television booth. So, I mean, they were behind. I think they've made strides. They may have made a stride or two more than Hendrick has, although Hendrick's got more wins. in the end, it was a good strategy call. I give him credit for having it out there, and it also led to some discussion about the commitment rule, which I know we'll get into here in a little bit. But, you know, Harvick, for once, actually lived up to the closer title.
Yeah, right.
I cringed and actually tweeted out about it when Letarte used the closer title on him, because I've argued this for years that he's not a closer. He has more second place finishes than he has wins, and I don't see how you call somebody a closer that doesn't win and comes in second. Jimmy Johnson has 83 wins. He is behind Kevin Harvick on the second place finish list. That's because Jimmy Johnson, for all arguments, is a closer. So, yeah, it's cool for the four team. It's cool for Stuart Haas, and I know it meant a lot. I thought it was interesting that you saw Greg Zipadelli actually come out onto pit road to congratulate Harvick when he came down for the lug nut check before he went back out to do his burnout stuff. You just see Zipadelli in victory lane, but you don't usually see him out on pit lane, and I think that said a lot about the importance of it to the organization.
For sure, and then in the post-race media availability, Greg Zipadelli was there on behalf of Gene Haas and Tony Stewart and said 2018, Cinderella year for Stewart Haas Racing, which it was. All four drivers won. They had won 12 total races, and at this point, they had won, what, eight or nine?
So, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, which they were on a tear, similar to Joe Gibbs and Team Penske this year. But, I mean, this is a big win for Harvick because he's been so close throughout the year. He's led a lot of laps, let a lot of races strip get away from him. Kansas comes to mind. He's been fast at other venues too, and he's led a ton of laps, but he finally, like you said, lived up to the moniker of the closer. And it was in a great last lap battle. I mean, despite what we say about the rest of the race, the last few laps, seeing Hamlin chase down the four car, then slip up the track, and then lap traffic getting Harvick's way. It was Austin Dillon and Quinn Huff who both got in his way in the final two laps. I was rewatching it last night, the final few laps, and Hamlin caught right back up, and he sent it down into turn one, and didn't really look like he lifted until he had to, and so he didn't crash Harvick, because he admitted didn't want to totally screw the guy. But then, you know, going down the backstretch was kind of interesting, because Harvick mentioned he was off throttle. Well, I was watching Race Up on Monday, and they were both off throttle, so much so that Harvick was ahead of Hamlin half throttle. And then ultimately, Hamlin went high going into turn three. What do you think? If he had a redo, do you think he would have went low?
Knowing that going high did not pay off, I think he would have. I was a little surprised he didn't, just because in the way that whole day played out and you knew how hard it was to get by the guy in front of you, it almost dictated that you needed to do a bump and run. And we saw it the week before, though, in Chicago. Kurt went in high, Kyle went in low, and Kurt got the momentum on the high side to grab the win. It just, this race, the high side did not pan off. When they were coming off of four, Hamlin was to the outside. I fully expected him to power by and beat Harvick by about a foot or so. And it just, that little bit of a touch or rub seemed to be everything that killed the momentum on Hamlin. But yeah, in hindsight, absolutely. Knowing that it didn't work, I guarantee he'd go in on the bottom. And he even said in post-race, it should have never come to three and four. You know, he moved him up in one, but he didn't move him up high enough. And if he had it to do again, he said he'd have pushed him up another lane, and then I don't think Harvick would have got back around him when it got to three and four.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of things that go into this enough, right? So a year and a half ago or so now, I think the way, and we talked about this offline, the way Hamlin races is a little different now towards the end of the race when he's in contention for the win, you know, trailing the leader, probably because of the whole Chase Elliott incident in Martinsville 2017. There's that. As far as Hamlin, you know, because eight tires are better than four. So if you go low and you're going to make contact, which, I don't know, I feel like you're going for the win. If Hamlin didn't have any wins, had he not won the Daytona 500, for instance, or Texas, I feel like the outcome would have been a little different. I feel like we would have had some more beating and banging for the win, and who knows, maybe Hamlin would have got the victory.
Yeah, I absolutely think that he races them way harder if he didn't already have a win in his back pocket. But I also agree that Martinsville still weighs on his mind. That was one of those things that you make a decision at the moment, and you don't you never fully know what the repercussions are going to be until you feel them. But I don't think he had any idea how passionate the following is for Chase Elliott and the amount of backlash that was unleashed on him. And people still hate him for that move. Absolutely weighs on him anytime he finds himself in this position again. And yeah, the situation of him already having a win in pocket, I guarantee, made it a little bit easier for him to not really, you know, just wipe him out in one. But like you said, these guys are all type A personalities. And second is the first loser. And he even said at post-race, losing sucks. And I absolutely promise he'd have done something different. He may not have won, but he would have attacked it different if they had it to do over again.
Yeah, he actually said, shit, second sucks on national television, which 15 years ago, that would have got you a $25,000 fine. Today's day and age, I don't think it's going to get him anything.
Well, your problem is you're on NBCSN.
That's truth.
Which is cable, so they let you get by with that. When it's on the broadcast, that's when they give you the fine.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, good run for Hamlin. You know, I thought they had pulled so far away from Eric Jones, like 5 seconds back or so is Eric Jones in third. He could get within 3/4 tenths, and then the final lap he got to his bumper, but I was, it is part of the package, and I don't know, maybe that says more about it than we think it should, but because when you're in the wake of the air, you can't really do anything with it. We see it at all types of tracks. Even with the 750 horsepower this week, when you have more horsepower, drivers make a little bit more of a difference than the 550, I would say, when you get on the gas, spin your tires, etc. But it's just so surprising to me that we live in a day and age now where you're 4 tenths for 30 laps and you can't gain anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's about how these cars are sealed off to the ground. I mean, there is no air that goes under the car. And that air that would get under the car, that would get back to the nose of the car behind, makes a huge difference. And when they're that sealed off, there's truly a void behind the car. And when you try to get to that void, there's no downforce on the front of the car. You literally lose, and I don't know exact numbers, but I've heard things like 800 to 900 pounds of downforce off the front of the car. I mean, you're talking about three fat guys being off the front of the car, and that's a lot of weight. And so the front of the car just skates up the track, so you got to get off earlier, you got to drive completely different, and it just, again, I don't think we're going to see any drastic changes to this package in the very near future, simply because we're going to have a whole new generation car coming for 2021. So I have to feel like they don't want to monkey around with it and have a bunch of teams spend a lot of money on R&D and then have to immediately turn right around and spend it again on a brand new car. So I feel like what we've got is what we've got. The powers that be in Daytona think it's entertaining racing, so that's what we're going to live with.
And for the, like I said, for the most part, I did think it was a good race, so I guess I thought it was entertaining. But like you said, only one pass, one like on track pass for the lead. Not fun, not cool. But now, someone who was cool and had a good day in New Hampshire was Eric Jones, who finished third, second third place finish in a row, fifth of the season. Now, you brought it up earlier. The commitment line violation that I thought was a violation but turned out not to be a violation because you need to have all four tires underneath the orange box, used to be a cone, and then go up the track to have it be a commitment line violation. He had two. His two tires were straddling the orange box, then he decided to go right and go up the track. Ultimately restarted second next to Harvick. He thought it was a violation, saying, damn, like, I messed this up on the radio, and I thought it was a violation. Seems like everyone thought it was a violation. I was listening to Door Bumper Clear. They thought it was a violation, all the spotters. What says you about this? Because we have a lot of rules, right? Like, it's too many rules. But I feel like this one might need a little more clarity.
I mean, I'm kind of indifferent on it. I kind of actually like that they have tweaked this rule a little bit. Because like you said, it used to be a cone. If you hit the cone, it was a violation.
Right.
And that was extremely black and white. But at this point, I mean, if you're not all four under, it gives you an out. Where before, if you hit the cone, it didn't matter. You could come to pit lane or you could go back out. It was still going to be a penalty. So I kind of like that it gives you an out. If you aren't able to get all four under, you have that option to swing back out and not get a penalty if you want. And it was in the rule book, but obviously it was a rule that was changed but not really pointed out to anybody. Because everybody, spotter stand, pit boxes, PR people, everybody thought it was a violation. And JC put it out there. O'Donnell talked about it after the race, and it was not. And again, I think it's a good thing because it used to be that you basically had a whole car width that could create a violation. And we got enough violations now and enough rules that are causing people grief that having the entire width of your car able to cause your violation is a little rough.
Now, I saw on Twitter, you, and I think I retweeted it, you said bring back the cone, right? I think they should bring back the cone, too. Because
I would like to see the cone back. I understand it from a debris standpoint why they don't keep it out there anymore, but I think it gives you a visual, and it makes it very easy for the drivers to see where that spot is. Because, I mean, seeing out the front of these cars is not easy. The first 15 or so feet, you don't see on the ground. And so when they're coming in and trying to gauge where a bottom, that's why it always cracks me up, and I don't know how they do it, but you see them do it all the time. In the pit stalls, before the races start, the crew members will tape off and measure out and put a little L with duct tape on pit lane where the left front tire is supposed to go. And the driver can't see that from like 20 feet away. And yet they invariably stop within inches of it every single time. I don't know how that is. It's just a matter of, you know, I think it's somewhat driver memory and also where they hold the sign. But it's amazing to me how close the drivers get to parking in the exact same spot every time they come into pits.
Magic. But enough with the strong run. Eric Jones, he gained 26 points on the cut line, came in just two above. Now it's 28 above. Granted, a lot of the guys near the cut line had a lot of problems and issues at New Hampshire. Whether it's Jimmy Johnson having, I think it was that he lost oil, water pressure, just like Chase Elliott did. You had Daniel Suarez getting an incident with Daniel Hemric after slipping in oil. Clint Bowyer drove up into Martin Truex, and they rocked on the front stretch, ultimately finished 20th. And then you had Ryan Newman, Eric Jones, both have good days. Kyle Larson had a bad day. But Eric Jones gains 26 points, which is a lot right now with only six races to go. Puts him in a little bit more comfortable position, heading to Pocono and Watkins Glen, two of his better tracks on the Cup schedule. What do you think about this 20 team? Because they've had a lot of speed this year, kind of quietly, though. But then they've also had a lot of incidents or bad luck, which Eric has been, you know, he's alluded to multiple times. You feel good about them going into, you know, this little stretch before the playoffs, also having a rival in Ricky Stenhouse Jr. now after the two made contact at New Hampshire?
Yeah, I don't ever feel good about it if you don't have a win at this point. Because you could lose, I mean, in reality, you could lose 60 points on a race weekend if your rival wins two segments in a race and you finish DFL. So it's, yeah, I never feel comfortable about it. I feel like they're running decent, and it's something that you know, they've got that one win, but I think Jones is still learning how to run these races and how to bring it home at the end. He's gotten better, definitely better than as a rookie, which they all are, but he's still got to, I still think he has to learn a little on how to win, and I don't know what it is. I try to figure it out. You know, because a driver really doesn't make that much of a difference anymore with all the engineering in these cars, and that's one of the complaints that your guys like Kyle Busch especially have, is that they can't really make a difference. But I feel like Eric strikes me anyway in listening to their radio and listening to their communications, like he has a very specific feel that he wants all the time, and that feel may not work at some tracks. And I feel like he's still learning how to drive to the feel that works rather than the feel he wants. And it may take a little longer for that to develop. But, I mean, he's proven he's got talent, and I think in the long run, he's another one of these guys that's going to be a star in the sport. They have quite a few of them coming up. But he's headed in the right direction. But we're about to get into some really interesting times, because I think over the next handful of races, we're at that point where running for stage points becomes a lot higher priority than it used to be.
Yeah, and we've seen him last year, and we've seen a lot of drivers over the past couple of years since stage racing was implemented in 2017. Pocono, it runs just like a road course, Watkins Glen road course. So the next 2 weeks, especially maybe even Michigan, you're going to see a lot of these bubble drivers probably finishing, I don't know, 1 through 5 in the stages, only because stage points are so valuable. I mean, 10 points. If you get 10 points for a stage win, that's a lot of points. That would, in the past, give you a 30th place finish just right off the bat. So, in case something did happen, you know, did go wrong later in the race. So, valuable points. I'm with you, though. I feel like Eric Jones, I think he's going to break out of a slump. Spoiler. I wouldn't even call it a slump, but I think he's going to break through, I should say. Maybe this weekend? You'll have to wait till later on the show to find out. But Neff, another good run for Matt DiBenedetto. Finished 5th. That's 2 top 5s and 3 top 10s in the past 5 races for Levine Family Racing. This team, and we've talked about them a lot on this podcast, seems that they've, not quietly, especially lately, they've really turned the corner right in the spotlight.
Yeah, they've taken advantage of the opportunity that has been presented to them. They're part of an alliance with Joe Gibbs Racing. They don't get the same level of support that Furniture Row was, but they're still getting Joe Gibbs equipment and Joe Gibbs technology, and they're in the competition meetings and what have you with Gibbs. So there's definitely more knowledge and more resources to draw on there than they had in the past. And needless to say, and we've all said it for years, that if Matt DiBenedetto got into quality equipment, he would show you what a driver he really is. And now he's in above average equipment. I wouldn't call it great equipment, but it's above average. And he is, again, getting the most out of it. So he, you know, obviously part of it has been super speedway stuff, which he's proven in the past, even in poor equipment, that he could super speedway race. And he's taken that to another level. But he's also starting to show out on other tracks. And, again, we've predicted him a couple times this year that he could very easily be a surprise winner. I think we see it coming up here in the next few races. He did well at Sonoma, so I think Watkins Glen's going to be a shot. He runs well at Bristol.
Very well.
So we may see that. And as you alluded to with Eric Jones having a new rival with Ricky Stenhouse, Stenhouse runs good at Bristol as well. So that's where I'm like, I'm more excited than I have been for a while for the Bristol night race, just because of the additional storylines I think that are going to play out, assuming that it doesn't become another Kyle Busch ass kicking.
Yeah, there's a good chance that could be the case.
But
yeah, you mentioned DiBenedetto. I mean, he finished 6th, 3 years ago now in BK Racing Equipment at Bristol. Yeah. So he can wheel for sure. And you hear drivers like Kyle Larson, who's touted Matt DiBenedetto as probably the most underrated driver in NASCAR, which I feel you could argue that, especially at the cup level. In decent equipment now, not great equipment yet, only because, hey, Bob Levine's very outspoken about it. He doesn't have the money that Barney Visser has, where Barney Visser owned a furniture company and had all this business background before even getting into NASCAR, where he could get this alliance with Joe Gibbs Racing after, remember, 10 years of grinding his teeth at the cup level. And you know, then he got the championship a couple years back. So, DiBenedetto, they've definitely turned the corner. I feel like he would tell you that too, definitely, because you look at their finishes, a 4th at Sonoma, road course race, 8th at Daytona, probably would have finished better had the race gone back to green. Maybe one. Who knows? We'll never know, literally. But then this weekend, New Hampshire gets his first top 5 in an oval. So they're putting it together on a bunch of different tracks. Got a little work to do with their 1.5 miles. They've been snake bitten by bad luck this year. But I feel like it's proven. It's turning around for that team.
Absolutely. They've And again, I think it's a matter of chemistry, too.
Yeah, Mike Wheeler.
I think having Wheeler over there as a crew chief has been a huge plus.
For sure.
Wheeler's not only is he super level-headed, never lets anything get to him, but he's been in the Gibbs system for a long time. So I think he knows what those cars are capable of and how to get it out of them. So I think that has helped give them pieces that are good off the truck. And then Matty D is taking full advantage of it once they get it off the truck. So, yeah, they have moved up in the racing order to where they're now racing at the front of mid-pack to the back of the front pack versus the back of mid-pack to the front of the tail end.
Yeah, you got to crawl before you walk and walk before you run. So they're definitely making the steps, no pun intended. But Neff, Ryan Newman was on the podcast last week. He said his goal for New Hampshire was to have fun. I was having fun watching him have fun racing in New Hampshire because he was up on the wheel. So fun to watch when Newman has a car underneath him that I thought he could have won the race had he got track position. But, you know, like you said earlier in the podcast, got four tires towards the end and can only gain six or seven spots in the final 28 laps or whatever the green flag stretch was to the finish. But he did gain the most in that time span. Finished seventh. This was fun to watch. And he said after the race, this is the most fun he's had in a long time in a race car. And I feel like you could tell that. And he's got five top tens in the past six races. No one's done that at Roush since Greg Biffle did in 2012. Neff, Newman, and he gained 23 points on the cut line. So I feel like he's going to make the playoffs.
I mean, he's setting himself up for it. Again, we don't know. I still feel like we're going to get one or two surprise winners in here that's really going to throw a monkey wrench into the standings and make the last race or two really exciting in a regular season. But I've been surprised. And mm-hmm. I've long been a critic of Ryan's. There's no doubt he's a wheel man. And, I've watched him since his days of Thunder days, or Thursday Night Thunder, back the greatest the greatest racing show ever to exist. When he and Gordon were out there running around IRP. And he has long been a wheelman. There's a reason that he's known as the hardest guy to pass because he simply drives that hard all the time. Reminds you a lot of Cale Yarbrough, actually. But he's always just kind of there. He was never really a superstar. And when they made the move to bring him over to Roush, I didn't think you were going to see any improvement. You know, I know Matt Kenseth gave them a little direction last year, and they kind of started to make some gains, but I thought they were just going to kind of plateau out there. And I have absolutely been wrong. With Newman over there, they're getting even better, and he's getting the most out of those cars, which we'll see if he can get a win out of it. I still think that's a stretch at this point for Roush, but at the same time, the vast majority of Newman's wins have been on strategy calls, so modern racing lends itself very heavily to strategy calls. So I think it's all lining up for him to be able to pull off some late race, no tire fuel run that ends up getting him into a win.
Yeah, for sure. When we broke the story of Front Stretch last year, I thought this was a huge downgrade for Newman. Because he was always on the bubble at Richard Childress Racing. He won in 2017 a Phoenix strategy call, which a lot of his races have been strategy calls for the win. But then you look at this year, right? And he's got eight top tens in the first 20 races. In the past year and a half combined, all the other Roush drivers, Stenhouse has seven total. But then also Kenseth and Bain, if you add in them from last year, only have two total. So in this year alone, he's got one less top 10 than the rest of the other drivers have in the past year and a half combined. So he's definitely added some value to this team. Kind of surprised that he's 15th in points because he has, like I said, eight top 10s. Now, he'll tell you, and he told us last week on the podcast that, they haven't gotten stage points this year. They haven't gotten a lot of them. Granted, they do have a lot of top 20s, but stage points mean everything right now, especially with six races to go. So we saw him stay out at the end of stage two and pick up eight stage points, which were valuable. Instead of being 21 over the 13 over the point line. Now they're 21 over the cut line and 15th in points. So, man, I'm liking where Newman's at because their ball is rolling right now, and they've got, like I said, 5 top 10s in 6 races. So, man, I think they're going to make the playoffs. And I know you could say, like, where's the last race of the regular season? Oh, it's Indy. Who runs well there? Jimmy Johnson. But I don't know, Neff, because when you look at Jimmy Johnson, back-to-back 30th place finishes, it's been a – he got off to a decent start. But since, I don't know, the 8th, 9th race, it's been pretty downhill.
Yeah, got off to a better start this year than he did last year, I think. But, again, fairy tale deal. He hasn't missed the playoffs since we've had playoffs.
Truth.
And I was there when he drove around Mark Martin on the outside to crush Mark Martin's championship hopes the year Hendrick went all in for him. And, I mean, that was a day. Understood that Jimmy was a great driver, but that was the day that cemented it for me. When I saw him, I mean, just take a car that was clearly not as good as Mark's car and beat him just spoke volumes to me. And that's where we talked about it earlier that if, you know, we get to Indy and Johnson's in a must-win situation, I think that's a storyline that you're going to have to watch because I picture it all coming together, Hendrick like throwing all their eggs in that basket to give Jimmy another shot. But yeah, I mean, at this point, Newman is poised and he's in the position and he's a smart guy. They are realizing, and you're going to see everybody realize how important stage points are going to be over these last handful of races because 20 points or 18 points or 17 points is huge when you're battling 3 and 4 points apart for positions. So you're right when you say that we're going to start seeing those 4 or 5 guys around the bubble all staying out to get those stage points. And in all honesty, I would not be surprised to see somebody's season come crashing to an end because they're going for a stage win and they get crashed out and end up with a DNF or something that ends up killing their hope.
Right. So I guess we can talk about the playoffs here in a little bit because it is a pretty tight battle, especially with Larson crashing out the other day at New Hampshire. But before we get to that, Neff, I have a couple more for you. Kyle Busch, so we talked about him a little bit, right? Led 118 laps, the most laps, had the dominant car, but got in the wall. Shouldn't have been a caution. We talked about that offline. Just scraped it and then called the caution. He could never get track position back and ultimately just finished 8th. So, I mean, I feel like that's – and we saw it like Richmond this year too. Had a fast car and just got mirrored in traffic. Couldn't do anything with it because he had a speeding penalty. That says a lot about the package, and Kyle's obviously been very outspoken about the package and his displeasure of it and how he dislikes it. But I feel like that's – the prime example, Kyle Busch not being able to race to the front like he has in the past.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge frustration, and it's not just Kyle. I mean, it's frustration for a lot of people.
Oh, 100%.
That you've got this situation where you get, and I mean, even at Chicago we saw it. Kyle Larson runs up there and passes Alex Bowman. Bowman gets past him because of a little traffic and a good run. And then Larson can't get anywhere near him the rest of the race because Alex took his line away and it just gave him no option. So, yeah, there's intense frustration with the package. And I mentioned earlier, the driver really doesn't make a difference. And that's a huge frustration when you're talking about guys that have worked their way to this level. And, yes, we can get into the discussions about money and sponsorship and buying rides and whatever. But the guys that are champions and race winners at this level got there because of the things that they can do and the differences they can make in a race car. And now they're in a scenario where it's more important what your crew chief does and what your pit crew does than what you do holding onto the steering wheel. And the powers that be call it entertaining racing, but I call it frustrating because the cream of the crop is not getting to show their true talents.
Yeah. 100%. I totally agree with that. I mean, we've been very vocal about the package on the podcast. you know, Ryan Newman comes on the podcast last week, gives it a C for a grade. He just thinks it's, he said it himself, he thinks it's a poorly developed aerodynamic package. And that's, I mean, that's pretty blunt, especially on a podcast like this. But Neff, we got a few more topics I want to talk about. I do want to give attaboy before we go any further to Alex Bowman, who finished 14th. Neff, we were talking offline. I didn't think he had any shot.
Backup car.
Yeah, in a third car. Now, let me take you through this, because he goes out to qualify. No problems in the first practice. Qualifying Friday, the drive shaft breaks. Destroyed the whole underneath the suspension of the car. So Saturday went to backup car. Saturday comes along, doesn't crash in the first practice. Final practice, only a few minutes to go, crashes. So then they take out the 48 backup car, goes into it, you know, into the race with never sitting in it, outside of just going through some of the interior things that he switched over from his 88 car to the 48. But they mentioned on the broadcast how it was still a stiff throttle pedal because they couldn't switch the throttle pedals at that time. So, Neff, I mean, take us through that, because that, I feel like that would give me claustrophobic being in someone else's office, essentially.
Yeah, I used this scenario to describe it before to somebody else. Imagine you've got a big presentation for your boss, and you're coming in early to make sure you put the final touches on and get it all perfect. And you're used to, in your cube, having your computer in a spot and your phone in a spot and your training certificates are on the wall in certain positions and your pens are in a certain place, your paper's in a certain place, and you walk into work 10 minutes before you got to go make the presentation and you want to tweak it, and your computer's on the other side of your desk. And the phone's on the other side of the desk, and your certificates are completely gone, and you're sitting in a chair that's too low to the ground and won't raise up. I mean, you're just, that's what it was like for him, because the team didn't have time to make the whole interior what Alex is used to. And every driver has their own preferences and their own quirks and their own way they like things, and he's going in there with Jimmy's compartment with a few things changed to Alex's life, but I've had to prioritize it and decide what was the most important things to give to Alex, and I gave that to him, but the rest of it he just had to improvise. And yeah, so he's in an unfamiliar surroundings in a car that was, you know, not on the track prior to the race, and comes home with a top 15. That is yeoman's work, not only by him but by his entire organization.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think of Hendrick as a whole, William Byron also had to go to a backup car, and then in the race, Chase and Jimmy both had problems. So, not a banner weekend for Hendrick Motorsports after, you know, a couple months of being strong. He had Byron, who's really turned the corner as a driver, and the 24 team. Chase has a win, but has five straight finishes outside the top 10 now. And obviously, we've seen what Alex Bowman has done with the three second place finishes in a row, and then winning Chicago. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, I feel like that's a small team morale victory for the 88 team with Greg Ives. And I mean, over the past 10 races, I saw a stat yesterday, they've scored the fourth most points. So they are a real, I don't know if you consider them a championship threat, but a sneaky pick maybe to go to at least the final eight, maybe the final four.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, we saw what Alex could do with Phoenix.
Yeah.
You know, when he filled in for Junior. So if by some stretch they made it to Phoenix or made it to the final round, sure, they got a shot to get to Homestead. I think that's a stretch at this point in time. I mean, we know they're going to be in the playoffs, and anything can happen in the playoffs. But I still feel like on a week-in, week-out basis, they're not contending for top fives as much as they need to be a true title contender. Again, like you said, they could probably make a final eight. I don't know that that's a huge stretch, but I think getting to Homestead would really take a scenario where he runs really well at Phoenix and somehow a meteor falls on the four car so the Harvick doesn't end up winning it. Because it's, you know, it's almost a foregone conclusion when Harvick goes to Phoenix. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's, it's been a boost not only for Hendrick in general, but I think for him as well. I
mean, oh, yeah.
I feel bad for Jimmy because I feel like they've been making some strides, and then they had that weird belt issue come up for them, which I know on the broadcast they tried to make it sound like it was the same thing that happened to Elliott, but I'm not sure because it seemed like, and I may be wrong, but when the incident happened that took Hamrick out, those guys hit fluid off of Elliott's car.
Right.
And you don't lose fluid just because a belt falls off. There had to be a fitting or a hose or something come loose that caused Elliott to lose some fluid. So unless he lost the belt and it knocked the hose off, I could see that. But otherwise, I felt like they were two somewhat different events, although they may have been related. But again, until the day comes that Jimmy Johnson is not entered in the race, I am still going to believe he's got a chance to win a championship.
At least a fighting chance, for sure.
Yep.
Now, I do want to give a shout-out to Chris Buescher. Finished 15th, now it's his ninth top 20 finish in a row. That's a career-long for him and for JTG Racing. Now, you can comment on that, or we can get to Eric Almirola, because I'm sure you saw this, and it looked odd from the beginning of when, right towards the end of the second stage. Eric Almirola got the stage win, right? But they restarted with a few laps to go, and it looked like he brake checked the whole field. What are your thoughts on brake checking the field at the front? Because, I mean, it could tear up a lot of race cars in the back. We've seen it happen a ton of times before.
Yeah, that's why there's a rule. The rule says you have to maintain and gradually increase your speed as you come through the restart box. You are free to begin increasing that speed in the restart box wherever you want to, but you have to maintain. And unfortunately for Almirola, they have those cool GPS things that they stick on the windshield of every car that allows them to gauge the speed based on GPS speed. And if you watch the broadcast, that little bubble came up above the car and showed that he slowed down to like 45 miles an hour. And caution speed was like 60. So he absolutely, he may not have brake checked him, but he left it off the throttle hard. And you can't do that at this level or at any level with restarts. Because when you're in there, you're all nose to tail, and you're all anticipating that the cars around you are going to gradually increase and then get on the gas hard when somebody goes. You're never expecting somebody to slow down. And the minute somebody slows down, the first two or three guys have no chance. I mean, they don't even realize they're slowing down. They just run into each other. The guys behind that start trying to brake check, but the guys way back don't see that coming, so they plow into them, and it just turns into a giant mess.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's a reason, there's a rule in place that says you have to maintain caution pace and then gradually increase once you go in the box, and you simply cannot slow down. And NASCAR got on the radio with Almirola and reprimanded him in no uncertain terms that they would not let that go again, and if he did it, he was going to suffer some severe consequences. So I think the message was delivered for sure. A lot of guys were screaming, and I didn't blame them, and it did screw up some people's days a little bit. So, I mean, I know games are played all the time, but that was extreme, and it just doesn't work.
And I agree with you. Games should be played, but not to that effect. You already have an advantage being the leader. The second, especially on the outside of New Hampshire. I mean, we saw all weekend how much of an advantage that was. You'd be if you restarted second, and this were the choose lane kind of we've talked about in the past. If you're restarting second, you're lucky to be fifth off the turn two. Honestly, now some drivers did do better than others, like Harvick, I think, or maybe it was Eric Jones on the last restart. He was right there with Harvick for a while. I think Kyle had a good restart from the bottom, but throughout the weekend, I mean, the bottom, and we've seen this at all tracks now. The outside is the preferred group primarily on restarts, so. You already have an advantage being the leader. Hey, games happen, but yeah, this was a little much. I felt like it was probably a warning. I mean, is a warning fair, or do you feel like from now on out, anyone that does it, or is that kind of warning for the field, you feel like?
I mean, it was a warning for the field, but at the same time, I think they'll issue it any given race.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they come at it like the driver's meeting, And if they come out of driver's meeting and, like, show a video of it and call Amarillo out and say, see, this is what you're not allowed to do. You've been warned and don't do it. Then it's different. But unless they make a serious point of it in the driver's meeting, they'll give you a warning during the race. Everybody knows that that's not cool. And it's one thing. You'll get guys that'll push the clutch in and hit the gas a little bit, because when guys are looking to go, they're going on the sound as much as the movement of the car. And so if they hear that engine rev, they'll try to goose it, and then they realize that the car didn't go, so they have to check back, and that's when the car will go, so they gain an advantage. I mean, that's gamesmanship. We do that all the time. But you just can't be dropping 15 miles an hour in front of 40 cars that are racing in anger.
For sure. Now, quickly enough, before we move to the Xfinity Series, we got six drivers, and we talked a little about the playoffs, but six drivers within 31 points of each other. Do you feel like the current playoff lineup is what we'll see? I know you keep saying you think we'll get a surprise winner. Who do you think that surprise winner could be?
I mean, I still like Stenhouse at Bristol. We've seen Stenhouse, even when Roush was bad, run good at Bristol. And now they're running better. We've seen in the past that with five races to go in the regular season, 95% of the time, that's who your playoff contenders are. But I feel like this time, it's not going to be. I feel like Stenhouse could easily pull off a win at Bristol, provided Kyle doesn't just stink it up. Or Larson, for that matter. Larson could stink it up there, too. I keep fixating on that Indy thing. I just feel like, and we get accused all the time, or NASCAR gets accused all the time, of manufacturing stuff and playing favorites, which I promise you, if you've ever spent 1 second in the garage, there's no way 39 teams are going to lay down and let another team win. But I really feel like Indianapolis and Jimmy Johnson is going to be one of those, like, Rudy stories where Jimmy's, 72 points out, so the only way he can make the playoffs is with a win, and he's going to come out and win the Brickyard. I'm just excited to watch it. As we said, I think stage points from here on out are going to be critical, and you're going to see some heavy-duty racing among those six or so drivers every stage throughout the rest of the regular season.
For sure. I think the 16 that are there now are going to be the 16 that we see. I just have a funny feeling. I mean, Cinderella stories do happen, and Jimmy Johnson hasn't won in 2.5 years almost. And, I mean, like you said, at any race he's entered, he could win. Any year he drives, he could win the championship. He could win the championship this year. Who knows? It could be like a 2016. But I think the 16 that are in there now stay, because Newman's on a roll. Larson's dropping a little bit, kind of a little bit worried about him. He's had a couple bad races here recently, and obviously the start of the year was terrible for him. He's honestly probably lucky to even be 13th in points with how bad the year's been at the beginning. But I think the 16 that we see now will be the 16 we see. But Neff, someone doesn't have to worry about making the playoffs in the Xfinity Series is Christopher Bell. New Hampshire is Bell's personal playground. He led 186 laps on Saturday out of the 200. Neff, this is kind of crazy. In four starts at the track at the national touring level, he's got three wins and a second. Not too shabby.
Oh, not at all. He's up there in Jimmy Johnson, Dover, and Kevin Harvick, Phoenix territory, where you assume when you go there that you're racing for second. And, we've beat the drum pretty good for Bell the last couple of years on this podcast about the fact that he is definitely a future superstar in this sport, and it's a matter of just where he's going to land and how it's going to play out. But I don't think there's any question that he's got the talent to go to the top level. I love the fact that he's paired with Jason Ratcliffe, and I think their personalities are very similar, and they just really work well together. Neither one of them, at a moment of intense, pressure, changes how they react. I mean, you can tell, you can be talking to them in the garage, or you meet talking to them when they're getting ready to make the final pit stop of the race, and they talk exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The example I use when Kenseth got basically knocked out of the championship for having too many men over the wall years ago. I mean, Ratcliffe was hot. But when he was talking to the NASCAR official, he was calculated, he was cool, he was factual. He didn't, you know, lose his cool at all. And they dealt with it how they had to deal with it. But I think that is a great pairing. And I think Bell, you know, he was a favorite to win the championship last year, and things just didn't work out well at Homestead. This time around, I think you're giving him a second shot. I think things are going to be far different, assuming he makes it to Homestead and has a shot at that title.
Yeah, I mean, he's proven he can get it done on all types of tracks. I'm kind of surprised by this, but like 75% of his wins or whatever at the Xfinity level, a vast majority of them have come on short tracks, a mile and under. I would consider a short track anything under like 3/4 mile, 7/8 mile. But you could consider New Hampshire a shorter track. Obviously, there's a lot of short track tendencies to the track. But Bell, man, he can get it done on the short tracks, which is kind of surprising to me. I always figured him to be one of the guys that hung it loose on the high line at or the low line at the mile and a half. But ironically enough, most of his wins have come at shorter tracks. And I agree with you. He's going to be there. He told me at Kentucky that by the time they get to Homestead, they'll be right there. You don't worry about them. So not calling his shot, but I definitely expect him to see him in Homestead. Now, Neff, do want to talk about an incident that happened in the Xfinity race. Paul Menard and Harrison Burton came with late in the race, late in stage three. Harrison Burton, Menard said he chopped him off on a restart, then door bumped him. What's your take on this? Because at the end, I think it was a little overboard by Menard, but I do think he was teaching him a lesson.
Agreed. It was definitely a teaching moment. I felt like the message was delivered a little excessively. But at the same time, this is one of those times, and we get into arguments all the time with fans about they don't think the Cup guys should be running in Xfinity and trucks. And I think this is one of those times, exact times, where it was a lesson. And teaching these guys at this level how to race means they have a shorter learning curve when they get to the Cup level. So the things that he did, right, wrong, or indifferent, ticked off Menard, and Menard felt like it was not racing properly, and so he sent him a message by dumping him. I like the way that Harrison handled it. He went to him. They had a level-headed conversation. I love the hat spin. I really thought we were going to have another ARCA hat moment, but he held on to it the whole time. But he had it pointed forward, then spun it back, then turned it back around forward. But he was honest with Paul. Paul's saying that he doored him, and Harrison's pointing at his car going, look, there's no donut on the side of your car. How did I door you without leaving a mark? And that's a valid point. So I feel like Menard is about as level-headed as they come. I can't remember the last time I've ever seen him wreck somebody on purpose. And he's also very good at bringing his cars home in one piece. So he knows when people are doing him wrong and potentially causing him to maybe wreck his car. And it was funny, I got into a Twitter discussion, I think it was last year with somebody, that made the statement that Paul Menard wrecks every race. And so I went back to the beginning of his Cup career and checked him against Jimmy Johnson. And Jimmy Johnson actually had more wrecks in the races than Menard did. And I thought that was a very interesting stat because most people don't think of Jimmy Johnson wrecking out very much other than plate tracks. And even tracks outside of plate tracks, he had more wrecks than Menard did. So, yeah, I never like to see cars wrecked because having worked on cars in my time, it's a lot of work for guys that didn't have anything to do with it. I'd rather had him meet him in a garage afterwards and have a discussion and tell him I was wrong. But, you know, sometimes during a race, you just get rubbed the wrong way and you don't want to wait for the grind. And I felt like that was that moment this weekend. It definitely sent a message to Xfinity drivers that you might not want to rough up Paul Menard or you may get the horns.
And that's the problem I have with it, is Paul Menard, a Cup driver, coming down to Xfinity race. It's only his third start of the year, I believe. That 12 car barely runs. It's ran with Brad a few races. And then with Menard, just twice this year. That was just the second race of the year. You're a Cup driver coming down to a territory where, I mean, this is where, not to steal the slogan, but
names are made.
Exactly, names are made. but then you got Harrison Burton, who's not a full-time Xfinity driver. He's a full-time truck driver, you know, fighting for his life right now to make the playoffs, sitting 10th on the playoff board. And we'll talk about truck predictions here in a minute. But he comes up, he's trying just to get laps, turn laps, get experience at New Hampshire. So when he does move up the ranks, he's ready and he has more laps. And, you know, Menard has all the laps in the world at New Hampshire. He actually runs decent there at Cup and Xfinity. So that's the problem I have with it. But I, like you said, I do like the way Harrison handled it. He's 18 years old. We've seen other 18-year-olds, or maybe a little older, like Joey Logano at Pocono 2010. When Logano came in the sport, everyone was ruffling his feathers, and he just letting it happen. He was just kind of a pushover until he stood up to Kevin Harvick at Pocono one day and ultimately said, you know, who wears the fire suit in the family?
Gotta wear the fire suit.
Yeah, so...
and I think the one point that I kind of, and I'm a little wishy-washy about, is Menard is Menard. He's not Kyle Busch. He's not Jimmy Johnson. He's not Dale Earnhardt. He's not a champion of the sport. He's a journeyman. And to have him coming down and try to teach lessons might be a bit much. But, again, at the same time, and we didn't really talk about it, but with Matt DiBenedetto running up front now, you race differently against the competition that you race week in and week out. And racing at the front 10 is different from racing at the back 10.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are different from racing in the middle 10. And so you're learning how to compete and how to get to the next 10. And it's different when you're in the back. You know, you're scratching and clawing and fighting. When you're at the front, you kind of bide your time a little more. And you pick your spots. And a lot of you spend more time riding. I mean, that's just the way it is. And it's, you kind of don't want it to be that way, but unfortunately in the sport it is. And I think that was one of those things that he was trying to get across to Harrison was, hey, you're up here near the front, you got to race like you belong up here at the front. And he felt like he was being a little too aggressive for the area they were in the pack, I think. But again, at the same time, I would have rather seen it happen in a garage after the race. Menard chose to do it when he did. They got some talking points out there, and a lot of people discussed it. Hopefully it changed a person or two's driving style as we go forward.
Which, by the way, very awkward position for Jeff Burton being on the NBC broadcast. But, I mean, because, you know, him and Harrison's mom are obviously big supporters. Harrison's mom goes crazy in the pits. Even during qualifying, she's up and down, jumping up and down, praying that, you know, her son does the best he can. And usually he does. He's, you know, running top five. It's not uncommon for him. He's jumped up the ranks really quick. Always races. He told me this at Pocono earlier this year when he was racing ARCA. He always races people that are a lot older than him, have a lot more experience than him, and obviously so, being just 18 and already making Xfinity starts. So I think we both agree, a bit uncalled for. Could have been handled a little bit differently. But hey, Harrison, I thought, you know, he's 18 years old, but he's way more mature than that. So...
And I think in the long run, it was a teaching moment and a lesson was taught.
Sure. For sure.
I don't know that it was necessarily a lesson that truly needed to be taught, but I think he learned a lot from it. I think Menard probably learned a little from it too.
Could be, yeah. All right, enough. So we got three races this weekend. Now, I'm going to be careful with the way I phrase doubleheader at Pocono, because next year it has a whole new meaning, literally, with the Cup Series having a doubleheader in the same weekend. But we got a truck race at Pocono, a cup race at Pocono, in an Xfinity race at Iowa. So let's start with the Xfinity series, since they'll be away from the Cup action. I'll be blunt. I'm going Bell to go back-to-back. He led 184 or 186 laps there in the spring and was really dominant. Won the last two races at Iowa. It's going to be tough to beat the 20.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I mean, it'll be a challenge for sure, but they can't win all of them.
Truth.
And somebody is going to get there and ruffle some feathers. I'm picking the teammate. It'll be an upset if it happens, but it'll be a great story if it does. I'm going with Riley Herbst. The 18 at Iowa has a history of success. And we saw Drew Herring win there in it. We saw Sam Hornish win in there in it. And I think Riley Herbst is going to be your next up-and-coming ARCA driver to make a statement and win an Xfinity race in the 18.
And then we're going to – the Truck Series are going to Pocono. Neff, who you got in this? Because we got a pretty good battle here towards the playoff bubble in terms of a lot of drivers are winning that are on the outside of the bubble, like a Tyler Ankrum or even Johnny Sauter, who's eighth or ninth in points. So you got – we've talked about this last week on the podcast. We got Grant Enfinger and Stuart Freeze in the top two in points, but could essentially miss the playoffs. So who you got winning at Pocono?
Nah, if they miss the playoffs, that would be amazing. As much as I want my boy Stuart Friesen to get it done, I don't think Pocono is where he's going to do it. We've seen Pocono in the past be a playground for first-time winners, and I think I'm going to go with Sheldon Creed getting it done in the two for GMS.
Hmm, that's a good pick. I'm going also a first-time winner, and we just talked about him. I'm going Harrison Burton. He needs to win in order for any Kyle Busch Motorsports truck to make the playoffs. Him and Todd Gilliland are 10th and 11th on the playoff grid. Kind of crazy, even, you know, with Kyle calling him out in the season that they've had. I still think Harrison Burton gets the victory lane, and then that would knock Crafton out, and we're going to Eldora next, where Crafton's a former winner. So... Neff, who you got winning the Cup race?
Oh, man, as much as you know, it's probably going to be Kyle Busch just because it's Kyle Busch. I feel like it's going to be a little different, and I feel like I don't know that we're going to have a new winner, though. And we've seen it in the past many times in this sport. People get on a roll, and it took a while for SHR to get it going. Well, I'm going to go Kevin Harvick. It goes back-to-back in a four.
Back-to-back. That's a solid pick. He's never won at Pocono and probably should have won about five times because I think he has five second-place finishes. I'm going to go with another guy that's proven to be pretty good at Pocono. We talked about him earlier. I'm going Eric Jones. He's finished third there in June. He's finished third there again before. Pocono is always one of his best tracks. He's got a good stretch of races coming up between here, Watkins Glen, where he got top five last year. Bristol should have won that race 2 years ago, leading over, I think it was 200 laps or so, starting from the pole. So I got Eric Jones breaking through and getting that victory, Neff, and I kind of spoiled it earlier when I said spoiler. So, Neff, any final thoughts on anything racing-related from this past week?
I do want to give a shout-out to Michael Self in the ARCA race at Iowa last weekend. The old hot rod got stuck in fourth gear early in the race. And every single restart, he pulled to the inside and let half the field go by him and then drove back around all of them to get back up to the front and in contention for the win. And unfortunately for him, there was a caution with like six laps to go, or the restart was with six to go. And so, yeah, he pulled to the inside and seven or eight cars got by him, and he fought his way all the way back. He finished third or fourth. But, I mean, it was just yeoman's effort. He had the best car there. Were it not for that transmission issue, I don't think anybody would have touched him. They've been on a roll this season, and I definitely think that they've got more wins coming, and I think he's probably one of the one or two guys to beat for a championship. One other thought, not necessarily racing related, but still racing related. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the family of Nick Harrison, crew chief for the number 11 for Colleague Racing, who sadly passed away Saturday night. Was at the track Saturday, and we woke up to that news Sunday morning. I'm actually going to write about it. If you watch Front Stretch on Friday, there's going to be a little column, not necessarily just about Nick, but just family in general in the sport. and the impact that some people make. And Nick was one of those guys that touched half of the garage, if not more. I mean, so many different people worked with him over the years, and no one had a bad word to say. I mean, he was one of those guys. I barely knew him. Had a few interactions with him, but just, you know, everybody talked about his smile, and that's the first thing I thought of when I heard about this, was that I'm not going to see that smile again. And, dude, you could be in the middle of a heated argument over car setup or driving or whatever, and he'd be in on it, but when you walked away, you'd be laughing because that was just the way he kept everybody going. And it's a huge loss, taken way too early from the sport. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Harrison family, College Racing, and everybody that had the honor of working with him. And I hate to see it happen, but we're going to be racing with heavy hearts the rest of the year thinking about it.
For sure, yeah, and I'll spend a little time talking about him too. Never, to my knowledge, can remember really having an interaction with him, but just looking off social media, whether it's an emotional post from Kurt Busch, Ross Chastain, Justin Haley, who was working with him this year at College Racing. I'm going through his racing reference page right now. Looks like he's worked with, I don't know, a third of the current drivers at the Cup level. He's won races with Austin Dillon, Paul Menard, Kurt Busch in the Xfinity Series. He has 5 total Xfinity Series wins, 1 truck win with Austin Dillon. So, man, that's such a tough loss. And I know how much he meant to Colleague Racing. Obviously, you know, just 2.5 short weeks ago at Daytona, celebrating victory in the highest of highs. And we don't want to speculate on what happened because nothing's come out yet. But, man, thoughts and prayers to the family. Thoughts and prayers to Colleague Racing. Because that's such a family atmosphere team. They got 20 employees, roughly. And they just do things the old school way. Led by Matt Colleague, who had this vision of growing the program, starting in 2016 with Blake Koch as the driver. They had Ryan Truex last year, and now Justin Haley this year. Got their first win with Ross, crossed the finish line, 1-2-3 at Daytona. Tough, tough deal for them. And, you know, stay strong, guys. Nick was a great guy, and he'll definitely be missed. I really don't know how to change subjects after talking about Nick and his importance in the sport and also his impact. But we have a conversation with Matt DiBenedetto coming up. As we talked about earlier in the podcast, Matt got his first top 5 on an oval this week at New Hampshire, and he's got 3 top 10s in the past 5 races, dating back to Sonoma and also Daytona. So let's see what Matt DiBenedetto has to say about his top 5 run at New Hampshire. All right, Matt, you've started 7th and finished 5th at New Hampshire over the weekend. Take us through your race.
Yeah, it was really good. It was a really good weekend for us, and the cool part was that it was we had speed from start to finish of the weekend, so it was no fluke. We just flat out had a fast car and ran up top 10 not even all day, just the whole entire weekend qualifying, practicing. In practice, we were third quick. We qualified 7th and, you know, raced up in the top 10 and ended up getting a top 5, which was huge for our team. So it was a great weekend and great execution.
Yeah, and in practice, I mean, it didn't go all as planned. You had the 2 left rear tire problems on Saturday. How nervous were you going into the race that could transfer over into the race?
Yeah, so that made all of us super nervous for sure. So it was, although it was a really good weekend, it was not a perfectly smooth weekend. So luckily all that happened in practice. But, yeah, we never got like a real definitive answer on exactly why or what caused it. So we just went a little extra conservative on some air pressure and things for that left rear on Sunday because we had no runs or anything. But luckily they addressed the issue, played it safe for Sunday there. And yeah, we missed an entire practice session and still, and that, you know, is a pretty big hurt to a lot of people because, you know, you have to be so perfect at the Cup level. And we still went out there and adjusted on the car on race day and still closed out a top 5. So that just shows how good our people and our team are.
For sure. Now, we saw some cars that were capable of making passes on Sunday. Some couldn't, though. So how challenging was it to pass at New Hampshire?
Yeah, it's always been a tougher place to pass. But this year, it was drastically harder than ever. Very, very much so it was a lot tougher because you would get into that dirty air, or almost like somebody explained it as an invisible force field, which was the funniest way that I've heard it explained. I was dying laughing, but it's totally true. So you get in that dirty air, the high downforce just makes it much harder to pass. It makes it where you can get stuck back in the field much easier. So so the thing that does is makes it you know, it's tougher, you know, more frustrating as a driver. So it puts more pressure on your, you know, team, crew chief, and pit crew to have to perfectly execute and get all the track position, because you know, that's the tough thing is if you lose track position, it can just end your day. Even if you're the fastest car on the racetrack, you just can't drive back up through there like we used to. So I'm glad we were able to get track position to show the speed of our car. And even, I mean, if you'd have picked us up and dropped us in third at the end of the race, we'd have finished third. You know, it's just it's kind of a game where we knew we had a good car, but you could pick us up and drop us even further up in the field, and we could just finish up there due to you know, I ran down the third and fourth place cars from quite a ways back. But you get there, and then you just get stuck. You get in there dirtier, and you get tight, and you just can't get to them, and you can't pass.
Now, Matt, prior to the weekend beginning, the track laid down a traction compound. I'm curious, did that help at all, in your opinion? And also, are you in favor of adding this to other tracks like Pocono this weekend?
Yeah, it helps a little bit. You know, and I think basically with the lower downforce, it wasn't as big of a deal, except for at Bristol, it was awesome to do no matter what rules package we have there. It helped the racing tremendously. Mm-hmm. So gave you some options there, but in some places it can help, and I think Pocono, so New Hampshire, it helps a little bit. Pocono, it can help, and we definitely need it. So that's the thing with this rules package, with the high downforce, you absolutely have to have lane options. You cannot run on the tire tracks of the car in front of you, or else it feels like you get two flat front tires. I mean, it's horrendous behind people. So with the low downforce, it wasn't as big of a deal. So basically, we're going to have to start, you know, if this is the path we're going down, we're going to start, you know, basically we're trying to manipulate the racetracks and just do everything to try and get us some lane options so we can pass. So it's, you know, low downforce would just make it better and easier, but we're kind of on this path, and so we're going to have to figure out a way to have these lane options to try and pass.
Of course. Now, Matt, you've always ran well, it seems, at the flatter tracks, like a Phoenix earlier this year. I think you're running 12th when you had a problem. At Richmond last year, you finished 16th there with GoFast. Now New Hampshire, obviously another flat track. So did you expect to have a strong run going into New Hampshire, knowing that you're pretty solid at these flat tracks?
Yeah, I did. I had some higher expectations for this one than maybe a mile and a half, you know, per se, because we're still improving at the mile and a half, and we're getting better. But, you know, those places, you know, it's a little tougher for us to kind of flex our muscle a little more at those, because you're really just kind of holding it wide open, and the driver doesn't come, you know, we can't quite make up for some of the things that we used to, since you're just basically in the gas all the way around. So these types of places, the flat tracks where you do, and it basically is short tracks, flat tracks, road courses, any of those where we're letting off the gas and using our feet to drive the car, letting off the gas and having to use the brake pedal again. That's where we circle off that, all right, we go out there, execute, we have good people, we get the car handling well, we know we have some good quality race cars, then we can go out there and outrace a lot of people. So that's the nice thing about those places, and why we kind of have places like New Hampshire circled off and expecting to run a little better.
Right, that makes sense. Now, on Twitter, you and Levine Family Racing posted your pre-race weight and then your post-race weight, and you lost 9.2 pounds, and obviously it was really hot in New Hampshire, but is that about how much you expected to lose, or did you think you'd lose more?
You know, that was, I've never weighed myself before and after, other than like when I got home, and I would step on the scale, and I'm like, wow, I'm really light, you know, and I'm still trying to hydrate. But doing it right before and after, I think that was even still a little more weight than I expected, just because, you know, it's just hard to even fathom that we lose that. I know I mean, I'm sweating so much, and it's easy if you don't stay on top of your hydration here. You're eating to cramp up easy and things like that, because it's just, I mean, you sweat so much. There's salt lines on my fire suits after the races, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that was still a little more weight than I expected to lose, just because it's hard to fathom losing that much weight when I know I still took in, you know, like 7 bottles of fluid to the car during the race, you know, and you're still dehydrated and you still can't even keep up with the amount that you're sweating out. So, and I also, after I got out of the car, before I even weighed in, I still downed a couple bottles of Gatorade and water. So, and I still was down over 9 pounds. So it's just unbelievable.
That's interesting. How much, because you're obviously big into CrossFit, how much do you feel like that helps in those hotter instances, like here, or even, there's been a lot of hot races this year?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a couple things that help me. As far as CrossFit and my workout, my training stuff, it is a really high intensity and really tough mentally on me, because it challenges me and makes me push myself to levels that I literally don't think I can do, so my mental threshold moves higher. So I think mentally in the race car, it helps me to block out the fact of the heat, and it just makes me a mentally tougher person in life in general. So that applies when you're baking in a 130-degree car and you're having to intensely race everybody. But aside from that, too, I think, you know, so the mental aspect helps, but I think, too, my training, where I focus on staying a little bit thicker, for lack of a better word, helps me in a race car, because I can afford to sweat out. You know, when I do sweat that out, I still feel okay. Again, for lack of better terms, I don't look like a wet noodle when I get out of the race car. I have enough to me to be able to sweat that out and still feel good, because I'm a bigger, you know, person than some of the rest. And then three, my hydration helps a ton. That's probably the biggest part, is having to have learned how to perfect my hydration over the years. And I've had to learn the hard way, too, you know. But that's taught me how to stay on top of everything to feel better than others by the end of the race when I need it.
Looking like a wet noodle. I don't think we'll be able to top that quote today. But
exactly.
Matt, 20 races into the season now. I know the season didn't start off the way you wanted. Had a lot of speed, but a lot of bad luck, too. So you got 3 top 10s in the past 5 races with 2 top 5s. Do you feel like the team's kind of turned the corner?
Yeah, you know, I laughed and I said, because our speed was there for a lot of races early in the season, but we just couldn't we just didn't have things go our way at all. But I laughed and said, if the law of averages works out, our luck was so terrible the first half of the season, it should be tremendous the second half. And, you know, it's nice to see that turning around, because it is a long season. So I was confident that it would, and I knew we had the speed and the people to do it. So, it's encouraging. I think this is just a sign of, you know, things to come, and I'm glad we're able to show what we can do, and I expect a lot more of it, because we just have such good people, and we're out here to show what we can do, and we're a growing team, and we want to keep on turning a lot of heads.
And from a personal standpoint, though, how much do these strong performances help your confidence, or help build your confidence?
A lot. You know, I've always had a lot of confidence in myself, which you need. That's one of the main keys to be successful in professional sports, is you have to be confident in yourself. You never question yourself. But it is awesome to go out there and show not only everybody, but prove to myself, like, yeah, I knew I was right all this time. I know I can go out there and run with the best of them. I have the ability behind the wheel to win any given day. If we all do our job right as a team and we hit it, you know, and we keep growing, I know that all of me and every person on my team has the talent and ability to go out there and win, and it's just huge, and it does do a lot for all of us and for me personally to go out there and know, like, hey, we just passed, you know, former champions and guys that I have so much respect for. We can race with the best of them.
For sure. Now, two more for you, Matt. We got some strong tracks coming up for you, Bristol included. You've always ran well there. Obviously finished sixth a few years back with BK Racing. Overall, what are your, some of goals, your goals before the playoffs, and do you feel like a win is feasible?
Yeah, I think it's feasible because, you know, it's there's a lot of teams that have, you know, not very many top fives, some really good teams that, you know, struggle to run up there where we have. So, and we've had the speed to where if just some little things fall our way, we, you know, maybe a late race caution comes out, you know. When you're up there in the top five, I mean, you have a shot. You have a shot to win. That's a big goal for our team. I'm not going to lie to you. We're still growing and, and getting there. But it's not out of the question at some of these racetracks where we do have those strengths, like a Watkins Glen, a Bristol, you know, a super speedway race. That's absolutely not out of the question because we've had, you know, speed and beat a lot of powerhouse teams at some of those places. So I think it would definitely be a bit of an upset if we did it, but we've shown that, hey, these top fives and top tens aren't flukes, you know. This past weekend, it's not like we just backed into it. At Sonoma, it's not like we backed into it. We just raced there and flat out beat other people. So I think it's a possibility, and it would be awesome.
Now, Matt, we'll get you out of here on this one. We're going to Pocono this weekend. You finished 17th there last month. What are your expectations for this race weekend?
This is another one of those where we're trying to improve at one of those types of racetracks, like the bigger racetracks where you are in the gas a lot, which is the opposite of last year. Actually, Pocono was almost, we treated it almost like a short track before because you were shifting and you used a ton of brake there. But now it's changed to one of those where we are really in the gas a bunch and you don't really let off much. So those are the ones where we're trying to improve at and get a little more speed at. We finished 17th there last time, and that's kind of around where we belonged last time. We were decent, could have had a shot at a little better finish. We had a better restart at the end, but I think if we can have good restarts and execute well, like, and apply all the things we've learned this year, and we're getting better as a team in those places, I would say I would like to shoot for a top 10 would be a great goal at a place that's been one of the tougher ones that isn't a short track and where we're not really letting off and using our feet to drive. I would say a top 10 would be a great goal where we would come out holding our heads high knowing that we're improving at those types of places.
Yeah, that would definitely be improvement. Matt, thanks for your time as always. Good run in New Hampshire, and we'll see you this weekend in Pocono.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Dustin.
All right, y'all, so there you have it. Fun conversation with Matt there. It was interesting to hear him chat about his confidence level, because as we've seen and we've said many of times on the podcast, even earlier in this one, we believe he's one of the most underrated drivers in the sport. It's good seeing good things happen to good people. And I say that because Matt and I originally recorded this on Tuesday, and it turned out that there was actually an audio glitch. So then I got a hold of him, texted him up on Wednesday morning, and said he'd be good to do this again. So definitely thanks, Matt, for his time and spending, I don't know, 15 minutes with us or so. But as always, it was fun talking racing with Neff. He and I had a little bit different of an opinion on the racing in New Hampshire, but overall, I was highly entertained for both the Cup and Xfinity race. But that's it for this week's podcast. Again, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, as it helps us out more than you'll truly ever know, more than we might ever know. But until next week's show, where we review Pocono, we out.